We have our final case, 11-340, Dayton Bar Association versus Georgiana Parisi. Ms. Anelli?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Diana Anelli, and together with Conrad Kuzik, who is to my left over here, we represent the respondent, Georgiana Parisi, in this matter. We're here today to ask you to dismiss this matter against her. The Constitution demands it, the evidence compels it, and the rules require it. Any attorney that had done research on the issues in this case as to whether Georgiana Parisi could have done what she did in her representation of either Green or Deming would have concluded that it is permissible. This board has stated that these issues are a matter of first impression, especially the conflict issue. The board has also opined in opinions that anything that is not specifically disallowed in the rules or the code, because this case involves both of them in some instances, is permitted. There is no way in the world that Georgiana Parisi could have understood that her conduct in representing either one of these individuals would have led to her being here today and the danger that she could lose her license. The Green case, which is the one I want to identify first, I want to talk about that a little bit first. The sole issue in that case is the right to contract. Mr. Green and Ms. Parisi have a First Amendment right under the U.S. Constitution and under our Ohio Constitution to form a contract for services. That is what they did. Neither the relator nor the board wants to acknowledge that a power of attorney is a contract, but that is exactly what it is.
So, counsel, if under your scenario, if the victim and the attorney agree it be a contract, there's no such thing as an exorbitant fee or a fee that is violation of any of the legal canons. Is that true?
No, that is not what I am saying.
No such thing as an excessive fee.
Oh, no, I think there is an excessive fee. I don't think there is an excessive fee in this particular case.
Because they contracted for it?
No, because under the factors and the evidence, which there is a plethora of evidence in this case, it doesn't amount to a clearly excessive fee. They contracted for services. Now, what is important here is this. If Ms. Parisi had taken under Rule 5.7, and set up a totally separate business apart from her own and contracted with this man to provide the very services that she provided in-house, if she hired the very same paralegals that she hired to perform those services, we wouldn't be here today. It would have cost Mr. Green a whole lot more, and the evidence, Peg Hennigman testified as to exactly how much more it would have cost Mr. Green, but her license would not be in danger.
Right, so, counsel, some of the examples that are put forth to us are: Green was charged $50 for a phone conference with Time Warner for the removal of a $5 late fee and an address change. $50 for a phone conference with Checks Unlimited to obtain for Green a $2 refund of an amount which has been billed to Green in error. $100 for a phone conference regarding a television set which the client picked up at the respondent's office. $50 for a phone conference regarding Green's penthouse subscription. $200 to straighten out the charges for a Ladies' Home Journal subscription and canceling the subscription. And they go on and on with these examples of the attorney billing at attorney rates for very minimal benefit.
Okay. And I want to address those. In fact, I would point you to the transcript. It's in the 1,000, somewhere between 1,010 and 1,025, somewhere in there, where Ms. Parisi, I asked her about those very charges, and she addressed what was going on in those very charges. And I have to tell you, that section of this findings of fact and conclusions of law, I find offensive, because what she had charged was not simply for those things. The $2 charge, there were no checks for which she could pay his bills. She had to call, actually, she didn't even call, somebody else called, she just reviewed and made sure that everything was the way that it was supposed to be, to make sure they could even get checks. What happens if the checks would have gone to somebody else and somebody else was using them? It would be Ms. Parisi and her license for dereliction of duty under this contract that would be held accountable. The whole thing with the TV set, that wasn't just a delivery of him to his TV of his TV set. She had a conference with him. She had to document the fact that he is taking possession of his own property. So in the future, when he loses whatever it is, or it somehow ends up missing, it doesn't come back to her. And she isn't held accountable under the rules for failure to account for where her client's property is. She's
so, counsel, I think the issue for many of us, or at least for me, is where the line is drawn. According to the evidence that we have in front of us, Mr. Green was a difficult client. He didn't have any family. He was very demanding, and it appears that certain times Ms. Parisi did suggest to him that he could get these services done more cheaply by someone else, and he wanted her to do them. She presented him with the bills. And I guess my concern would be, while I don't disagree with some of the statements you've made about payment for her time, is when you're dealing with elderly clients, is where do you draw the line? Where does it then cross over to being taken advantage of the client? I think Mr. Green was perfectly capable of being able to say, I want an attorney to handle this, whether he needed an attorney or not. But where does that bright line come in that we make sure elderly people in his position are protected?
Well, Justice Brown, I'm not exactly sure that you can say where a bright line, you know, I mean, we're getting into shavings here. I don't know that what you can do. Under Rule 1.5, it's an individual case. You have to look at all of the factors in the individual case.
Were there any competency issues with Mr. Green?
At the end. When he first signed the power of attorney, there were not. That was in 2004. In 2006, he was failing. One would expect this. He was elderly, number one, but his major problem was that he had diabetes. The man was dying. He knew it. And so there were some competency issues around the end of 2006. He fell, broke his hip, went into a nursing home. They resolved. He came back out, and a lot of these were his own, you know, his own doing, because he would do things that would, like, drink. You know, he's a diabetic and he liked to drink alcohol. Well, you know, that's his right. It's his life. If he wants to do that, okay. At the end, there were more competency issues. But understand this, too. These aren't tasks that Ms. Parisi is performing herself. The performance of the actual task costs much more than the 0.25 that you're looking down at. That is there. The bill is of the nature that...
Who did perform the task, counsel? Who did perform the task? I'm a little unclear here.
The staff, Ms. Parisi's staff that she hired. So when you're talking to Time Warner...
And what was the charge for the staff? Was there an hourly rate for that?
No. All right. Yes and no. When the staff was performing things such as calling Time Warner inside the office, the staff's time was not charged. And Ms. Parisi said, I couldn't do that. It would be cost prohibitive for anybody to bear that kind of thing. I had to come up with some reasonable way of being able to accomplish his goals, keep him out of a nursing home, keep him out of guardianship, and keep my lights on. So she hired the paralegals. The paralegals did the work. The paralegals documented the work, because when you're dealing with
people... What was the rate that was charged for the paralegals?
For the stuff that was done inside the office, no charge at all. Only her charge for her review of what they did, which of course she has to do. When the paralegals did certain discrete tasks, or when they were outside delivering stuff or working on his behalf, she charged $100 an hour, which everybody agrees, even the relator agreed, is reasonable.
Were they doing legal?
I'm not necessarily in agreement. If it was non-legal matters, as my understanding, there was a lot of non-legal matters that were done. If the paralegals at $100 an hour, wouldn't it be better to hire non-paralegals at a rate that is more customary for people doing non-legal work?
You know, Your Honor, Peg Hennigman in the, I think it's somewhere between the 600 and 800 block of the testimony addressed this. And she said, in point of fact, no, it would have been more expensive. Because when you are talking about those kinds of tasks, you are talking about people that do it at a flat fee. You are talking about delivery services that occur at a flat fee. And it actually would have cost him much
more. And there was nobody available that would do it at $25 an hour. You're saying there's those kind of people don't exist. You can't hire them.
You know, Your Honor, now you can. But back in 2004, there wasn't any.
Nobody would work for $25 an hour.
Well, I don't know if there was anybody that
would. I mean, anybody that was trustworthy.
Well, okay, now we get into another issue because we're dealing with money. So are they trustworthy? In order to make sure that they were, she hired them. She bears the responsibility. If they steal his money, it's on her. It's her license. It's her insurance policy. It's on her. To me, that is a reasonable way to handle this. And let's not forget, Mr. Green's money was stolen by a worker in the assisted living home that was providing services under a separate contract with Mr. Green through the assisted living facility. Ms. Parisi had to come along, straighten it all out. There were criminal prosecutions, and get it all reversed. So that's the danger that you are running when you are talking about this kind of thing. Understand, she's providing so much paralegal services for zero. At some point in time, you have to charge something for when your paralegal actually is out doing a task. And that's what she did. And she charged at the normal paralegal rate. And if you take a look at the paralegal charges, they were actually very reasonable for the services that were performed.
So she was having her paralegal charged at $100 an hour, and then she was charging anywhere from $2 to $2.25 to review what the $100 an hour paralegal was doing.
No. And you know, we had a hard time at the board trying to explain this too. No. Ms. Parisi would have the paralegals perform tasks in-house, charge zero. Charge her time for reviewing what they did only.
And that's where her bill for like $200 for arranging the Time Warner came from, and
right.
The $50 for reviewing phone conversations and the various other ones that are detailed here.
Well, and plus there were a lot more in there. You know, you're talking about the Ladies Home Journal. That actually was another theft incident where the former power of attorney was actually buying the Ladies Home Journal and other magazine subscriptions, having them delivered to her home, and charging Mr. Green's accounts for that.
The board made a finding that $231,000 over this period of time was a clearly excessive fee.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The board made a finding
yes.
that the $231,000 charged
yes.
was clearly excessive.
Yes.
Are you admitting that or are you contesting that?
Oh, denying. Absolutely denying. No, there is
your view
nothing.
Is it was all earned.
Yes, absolutely. They say it was all earned. You know, the relator started with saying, this is theft. This is a Alsfelder case. This is a Blair case. This is a misappropriations case. And the board came back and said, no, it wasn't. She did all of those tasks that are set forth in there. And the evidence is overwhelming about the amount of work she did. Charlene Vios, Nick Vios, Chris Christensen, Georgiana Parisi, Peg Hennigman, Stephanie Allen. All of those people testified. Three of those people actually worked on the case, and there was another.
So, counsel, there's no dispute that she might have put this time in, but there is a dispute about the value of that time.
And there shouldn't be a dispute about
the
value.
Well, you say there shouldn't be, but obviously there's a whole panel of people that says that she charged at legal rates for things that didn't require a $250 an hour attorney to do.
Okay. Relator says that. The board, here's the fundamental problem with this. Relator's a litigator. We have three members of the board. One is a prosecutor. On the record, she said, I don't even bill for my time. Another one is a litigator. On the record, he said, I don't even think I could find probate court in my jurisdiction. The third one was the chair, Mr. Elliman. God love him, he did a wonderful job in this case. I don't agree with his conclusions, but he did do a good job. And he said, well, I've been a receiver, I've done those kinds of tasks. Nobody has an appreciation for what it takes to be an elder law attorney. Nobody has an appreciation for the amount of time and the liability that you set yourself up for, not just through insurance and malpractice, but through the family of the people that you're taking care of.
Do we need then to clarify whether or not charging $200 per hour as an attorney for performing non-legal work is a reasonable fee? Is that an issue for us to talk about?
No, that is not an issue for you to talk about. There is no evidence that she charged $200 an hour for non-legal fees. Wait a minute. Yes, there is. But it's not an issue because everybody agrees that it is reasonable and that she is permitted to charge her regular hourly rate under a contract for non-legal work if she wants to. Receivers do it.
That's agreed.
That's agreed.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if Mr. Tuss will agree to that.
I'm going to ask him.
Okay.
Ms. Zanelli, you are denying that this is a clearly excessive fee, and one of the statements in the panel's report here says that they believe that the respondent would not likely ever repeat this behavior. And from what you're saying here, it seems that you believe, as you stated, you think the whole case should be dismissed. So are you suggesting that this is the method that would be used in the future by your client? And if so, that seems to fly in the face of the recommendation of the panel here.
Ms. Parisi said on the record she will never do this again. It's just too fraught with possibilities to end up here. There is absolutely nothing that in the rules that prohibits this kind of thing. And like I said, 5.7 actually permits it.
Thank you. Mr. Tuss?
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice. Good morning to all of you. My name is Mark Tuss. I'm the attorney for the relator. I'm not going to go through these binders, but I wanted you to see those are just two of three binders that we had in terms of exhibits at the 4 days of hearing in this matter. This case was not taken lightly. If you listen to Ms. Anelli, it was all some misunderstanding.
Is this a case of excessive billing?
Exactly. The findings of the panel are on three issues, okay? With respect to a Sylvia Deming who comes later in time, that is a conflict case. They found a conflict, and also a prejudice of justice claim as far as Sylvia Deming and the handling of that. In terms of John Green, who was earlier in time, that's the excessive fee case. Under 1.5.
And was there a finding by the board with respect to the excessive fee?
I'm sorry.
Was there a finding by the Board of Grievances and Discipline as to a clearly excessive fee being charged?
Yes, Your Honor. All three of those were the findings. We have three violations. What the Dayton Bar Association objects to, and the reason we filed objections, is not to the findings. I could, and I will address to the panel, the issues of mitigation versus the aggravating factors. I'm not sure I agree with them entirely on how they did it, but we certainly disagree with the discipline recommended by the panel and adopted by the board.
If I understood Ms. Anelli, she said everyone agreed that this was not an excessive fee.
Well,
I disagree. Could you comment on that?
Sorry. Yeah, I disagree with that entirely. No one, either me as relator's representative or relator in terms of anyone communicating with me, has ever taken a position other than what was set out in the complaint. We didn't litigate this for 4 days simply to say we agree.
Can I clarify what we're not talking about? Because you cite some cases in your briefs that really are very distinguishable. A lot of these excessive fee cases, we don't have any documentation backing up what was done. This case, we have extraordinary records, detailed records, as to all the work that was done, and the dispute is more about what time was charged for those. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, I think we tried to lay that out in a letter to Ms. Anelli and Mr. Kuzak, where the areas
Is that correct?
It is on the billing, yes, Your Honor. I think the problem with the billing is that Ms. Parisi, as respondent, tries to hide and make things opaque by having a 404 or 407-page bill.
Whether that's the case or not, we have a lot of documentation. You may dispute what that fee is for the documentation, but she documents all the work she does. So we have to decide as a court, is the amount she charges for that work appropriate as an attorney, correct?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree. I don't believe anyone, and we didn't present any expert testimony, as to the rates, whether it was paralegal rates or attorney rates, as being unreasonable. What we presented to the panel, and what they obviously felt was proven by clear and convincing evidence, was evidence of duplicative billing. In other words, I spent hours, literally hours, going through. The reason I set that out there was to show you what Relator's Exhibit 7 is. That is this binder, which came from respondent. That was an exhibit attached to a motion for summary judgment when she sued the estate for a fee. That came from respondent. That's not something conjured up by the Dayton Bar Association or Relator. In that binder, when you compare paralegal time versus attorney time, you see double billing. When you go through that binder.
Well, counsel, I guess her response to that would be the paralegal did something, and because of her responsibility as the employer slash attorney, she's got to review the paralegal's activity, and that is going to be charged at the 2 to 2 1/4 rate for her to be the overseer.
Well, Your Honor, that may be an explanation that would come from respondent. That's not what the panel decided when they heard the evidence. That, you know, we cross-examined, we call respondent as if on cross-examination, and the panel heard the testimony. So what you just said might be an argument that respondent might throw back, but it's not what the panel heard and, if you will, understood were the nature of the facts.
Okay,
this is not simply a big bill that's justified. This is a big bill that is unjustified, and we presented through our testimony and witnesses how that's the case.
Is there any testimony as to what the amount of fees should have been?
Well, Your Honor, no. There were no witnesses. I mean, we've got $231,000 more or less collected. There's another amount charged. She sued.
So ostensibly done pursuant to a contract with the client?
No, Your Honor, not at all. If you would, it's very clear, and the findings of the panel set this out. There was no engagement letter. There was no representation agreement setting out either the scope of work or the fees to be charged. Ms. Anelli wants to call a standard financial power of attorney some kind of a contract, which doesn't include anything in terms of fee rates or the scope of work. It's a powers. It's a grant.
Is there any finding by the board that there wasn't an engagement letter as a violation?
Well, I don't know as a violation, but certainly as a fact in this case, not as a violation. I mean, I think that if you look at Rule 1.5, it's not a violation not to have an engagement letter, not to have a contract of employment. It's called preferred or you know, the Supreme Court has kind of laid some.
One of the counter arguments is that by keeping him out of a guardianship and out of a nursing home pursuant to his desires, he actually ended up paying a lot less. What is your response to that argument?
Well, Your Honor, it's not a question of what Mr. Green would be paying. It's a question of what Ms. Parisi obtained. In other words, the goal is not to end up with this man money to go to heirs or anything like that. It's to preserve his wealth for himself, whether it means care. No one can decide when someone's going to need nursing home care. When she's spending money on herself in a self-serving way, writing checks to herself, okay? If you look at Relator's Exhibit 7, which is the 404-page bill from Respondent, the last six or seven pages are like a check ledger. She is writing to herself checks four, five, six times a month. It's not like what I do. I bill maybe monthly. If we have funds in trust, you take the money out to pay that trust bill on a monthly basis. She, meaning Respondent, was using Mr. Green's wealth as an ATM. I'm not saying that because I have animus. That's what's reflected in Exhibit 7, Relator's Exhibit.
For what purpose?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
For the checks for. What was the
notation? Checks were to pay for her fees. In other words, when they needed money as far as cash flow within the firm, they simply wrote a check.
And you are claiming she had not yet earned the fees?
No, Your Honor, I can't say that she had not billed for it. Earned it is a tougher question.
Illegal to take fees out as you earn them? You only have to do it, you can only do it once a month? I'm not getting the connect why that's illegal.
Well, Your Honor, I think as a practicing attorney, what that tells me is that this is not a bill that goes to a client, okay, and then you somehow take that out on a monthly basis or a periodic basis from your trust account or some kind of an account where funds are sitting. This is really, okay, it's the end of the week, we need some cash, we write a check, and we write out of John Green's funds.
Except she kept copious bills. She, and Mr. Green, we could debate all day long as to whether he needed an attorney to do most of his daily life skills, but that's what he wanted. That's apparently what he asked for, and he reviewed the bills. So I'm with Justice Stratton trying to figure out, is the issue that the fee was too large? Is the issue that she took her fee too frequently? Because certainly I don't think that your argument is that Mr. Green could not contract with Ms. Parisi to do whatever it is he wanted her to do.
Well, Your Honor, I think my answer is yes and no to that. Okay. First of all, under Rule 1.5, which is the excessive fee rule, okay, it talks about A1, and this was set out in a letter to Respondent's Counsel before we started any of the hearing. You have to look at the time and the labor required, the novelty of what's going on. There was nothing novel about this work. You could argue that it was non-lawyer work at lawyer rates. I don't want to get into that because I think the billing itself was excessive because it duplicated, it did things that were of no benefit. Then A4 talks about that the amount involved and the results obtained. For instance, there was a vintage car that was being restored. And we're not talking about payments to the restorer, the guy, the grease monkey, okay? We're talking about payments to Respondent of over $13,000 for being on the phone, talking with the guy restoring the car. That's what we're talking about. Now, I don't reference that because it's a well-documented bill. I reference that based on the rule that you have to look at what's the benefit to the client. I will tell you, Ms. Anelli references a Ms. Hoagman, who testified on the second day of hearing. She was a paralegal, now a lawyer, worked in the office of Ms. Parisi, and she testified that over 40 to 60% of the office time was billed to John Green. That was a client that Ms. Parisi could not say no to. That was a client she couldn't turn off the spigot for.
Well, her response to that was that she gave up all this other business in order to accommodate this one client, and that is another justification for her in these $231,000 that was taken from his account.
Again, Your Honor, in all due respect, I think that's an argument she could have made. It was not an argument she did make, and it was not an argument that the three-member panel, if she made it, and I don't remember hearing it, bought, if you will, or accepted.
Our responsibility is to write a rule of law in connection with all lawyers who are doing and engaging this kind of activity. Your argument is this is a lot of money taken out, but you haven't clarified for me what it is specifically that should have been done. In other words, was $200,000 fair? Was $100,000 fair? What is the evidence show as to the specific violation, and what rule of law should we write to tell all the lawyers who are engaged in this kind of activity how they should bill in these circumstances?
Mr. Justice O'Donnell, I think the rule is fine. The last thing I think I should be instructing you is to rewrite rules, okay? I think the rule is fine. I think you have to trust the profession. And what I'm saying here is this lawyer violated the rule. It's a matter of conduct. I don't think that there's a gauge. Some of the cases talk about non-lawyer work and lawyer work. I find that not to be helpful because I know old school lawyers who do things for their old school clients that are not, you know, litigation or even drafting documents, but they do it because the client in a way has become as much a friend as a client. So I would hate the court to start adopting this. You can charge for this and you can't charge for that because it's lawyer, non-lawyer.
I don't think it's the issue of what you can charge for and what you can't charge for. It's the rate. That's what I think is very problematic here. The duplication of redundancy, I'll say, and the fact that there were exorbitant rates charged for activities that were non-legal, arguably not even paralegal responsibilities. And there were alternatives that were not employed here. And the $231,000, and the only way you can judge it is against the benefit that was afforded the client. And that's the disparity here, that I see the board, the panel and the board recognizing, and that's where you have a clearly excessive fee. You didn't get your money's worth.
John,
that's basically
Green.
your the justification for a clearly excessive fee. You charged more than what was reasonable for the activity and the services performed.
Right, and when you look at this relationship, Your Honor, the beneficiary here really is the respondent, not the client, because she reaped $231,000 of fees.
Mr. Tuss, turning to the sanction, because I know that's where the Dayton Bar is, objecting, the panel had talked about the presumption for a state suspension when we're talking about clearly excessive fee, unless there's a finding of fraud or dishonesty. So my question to you is, does the Dayton Bar believe that this is a case that is not adequate, that the state suspension is not adequate because there was evidence of fraud or dishonesty?
Well, Your Honor, I do think the discipline recommended is inadequate, yes. I asked at the hearing several times about other clients other than Deming and Green, and it was objected to and it was sustained. The Dayton Bar Association doesn't know if there are other John Greens, followed by, if you look at the chronology, Sylvia Deming in Ms. Parisi's files, okay? When you look at the guidelines under Section 10 of Appendix Roman numeral 2,
that's speculation. That's not a basis for increasing sanctions because you think there's somebody else out there.
Well, Your Honor, in the other cases, this court has ordered probation with some monitoring. If there is a monitor placed on Ms. Parisi's files, that monitor can go in and look to see if, as Ms. Anelli now says, that respondent will never do this again.
What's your recommendation for a sanction?
My recommendation for sanction is at least a definite suspension. That would be a year or two. If it's going to be stayed, any portion of it, that during that stay, like any other setting, that the respondent be placed on probation with monitoring.
What about restitution here?
Well, restitution, certainly, Your Honor. I mean, the estate, I believe, is still open for John Green. Ms. Deming is still alive, but I believe restitution, at least the fee that was...
Didn't the money go back to Ms. Deming already?
Yes, Your Honor, that's where I was going. Yes, she received those funds back. So the restitution, if you will, in any fair world was complete with respect.
But you're saying that there should be a certain amount of restitution because she took all $231,000.
That's correct,
Your Honor.
Hasn't
been given back yet.
That's correct. There was a settlement from Ms. Parisi's malpractice carrier for, I want to say, around $21,000, which resolved a lawsuit that she initiated against the estate for fees for probate work. So this was all in the mix, but it was certainly not restitution, at least in the eyes of the relator.
One of your recommendations includes her ongoing compliance with the Ohio Lawyers Assistance Program?
Yes, Your Honor.
There's an issue of substance abuse here?
Well, Your Honor, one of the witnesses on the, let me get my papers here. One of the witnesses at trial was a Mr. who was the OLAP counselor. It was a David Ward Tilton, and he was the OLAP counselor, testified when we had the 2 days of hearing in Dayton, and testified as to Ms. Parisi's OLAP process. And I would point out to the court that Mr. Tilton, on cross-examination, admitted that she said to him many times she didn't know what she did wrong, which I view in terms of the factors of aggravation and mitigation. She doesn't get it that this kind of billing that is, in my opinion, excessive just in the sense of its fastidiousness, okay, and duplicativeness.
Well, is she under an OLAP contract or not?
I would think you would reserve that question for Ms. Anelli. My understanding, she is. I didn't know that it had ended, but I don't know that it continues.
What's you know the what the condition was that precipitated the OLAP?
Excuse me, Your
what
Honor?
What condition precipitated her involvement with OLAP?
My notes reflect that in the record, it would also reflect that, because this was the testimony of Mr. Tilton, that she began in the spring of 2008 upon a referral by Mr. Kuzak, who's here in the courtroom today as counsel.
All right, thank you.
What's the amount of the restitution you're seeking?
Well, yeah. Your Honor, I think restitution is less important than getting inside these files.
Then what?
Than getting inside these files and doing a job on behalf of the public. That's what we're here for. We're not here necessarily. I'm not sure restitution to the estate is going to make that much difference.
Well, you asked us to do it, and I'm asking you how much you are seeking.
Well, Your Honor, I think the entire fee is excessive, so I'll leave that with the court then. The whole 231 that was paid.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Anelli, you've used up all of your time. You can have 30 seconds.
Your Honor, I do want to address the OLAP question. There is no substance abuse, Justice Brown. She was sent to OLAP because, as a result of all of this, she went into depression and she was suicidal. That is why she is under a OLAP contract, which continues now to this day. We offered evidence on that. Mr. Tuss didn't recall that. As regards to the fee, understand Mr. Tuss can't give you a dollar because he has on restitution because he has no idea how much money the fees were worth. Take a look at AAAA. He just told you he went through 404 pages of bill and it took him hours and hours and hours. He said to the board, they're all documented in there, almost $18,000 worth of fees that he thought was excessive. The board, take a look at the findings of fact and conclusions of law, determined that she had already waived $23,000. So how do you get a clearly excessive fee if she charged $18,000 too much, but she waived $23,000?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take the matter under advisement. You will be notified of our opinion.